Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Elmore Leonard. A storyteller from the start, Elmore wrote his first play at the age of 10, utilizing the furniture of his fifth grade classroom as stage props. In 1949, he began his professional writing career in advertising, penning westerns on the side and primarily selling them to pulp magazines. One of his first publications, the short story 310 to Yuma, went on to be adapted to film in 1957 and again in 2007. In 1961, Leonard became a full-time writer, adding crime fiction and suspense thrillers to his list of genres. He published more than 50 novels, short stories, and screenplays throughout his 60-year career. The most famous among these include the novella Fire in the Hole, which served as the basis for the award-winning television series Justified, and the novel Rum Punch, which was adapted to the 1997 film Jackie Brown, directed by Quentin Tarantino. In total, 26 of Leonard's novels and short stories have been adapted for screen. Leonard's writing has been praised for its gritty realism, witty dialogue, and snappy pace. In his 2001 New York Times essay, Elmore Leonard's 10 Rules of Writing, now famous among writers and critics, Leonard writes, "I try to leave out the parts that readers tend to skip." He frequently cited Ernest Hemingway's writing as influential to his own work. Among his awards and honors is a 2008 F. Scott Fitzgerald Literary Award for Outstanding Achievement in American Literature, a 2009 Penn USA Lifetime Achievement Award, and a 2012 National Book Award. Elmore Leonard died in 2013 at the age of 87. Now, from the 1996-97 series of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Elmore Leonard speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
I'm the Dickens from Detroit. I've often wondered, what if I were from Portland? What would I be? Who would I be? Or Buffalo, or wherever. I was signing books a few years ago in Los Angeles, and a fellow came up to me and he said, "You know, a letter of yours was auctioned off at a library fundraising, and I bought it, and I paid $500 for it." And I said, "You paid $500 for a letter?" I said, "Why don't you give me your address?" No, really, I felt that he deserved more than just a letter. So I'd give him another letter. In fact, I did. I wrote to him, made up some things. And then I included a typescript of whatever the book was at that time and sent that along with the letter. And a few months later, at an American Booksellers convention, I heard that he had sold the two letters and the typescript for $1,250. And then I thought, well, if I ever run out of gas here, then there could be some good money in letters. But not so much my letters, letters that I've received and reactions that I've gotten from readers and critics and so on to my work. And I'll give you an example. A letter begins, "I am a 12-and-a-half-year-old girl who has read many of your fast-paced, entertaining novels and learned much about plotting and pace from them. Glitz, Gold Coast, 52 Pickup, Touch, Stick, sound familiar? I own paperback copies of all of them, as well as a hardcover Get Shorty. I won't mention the movie versions because I haven't seen them all, and the others are not your fault. Besides, you wrote 310 to Yuma, and that's a classic, as you know. I know you've overcome many personal problems that I won't mention. Congratulations. I would love to write books like yours one day, but I know you're supposed to write about what you know. And frankly, I'd be afraid to hang around all the sleazeballs, lowlifes, psychos, and con men you've obviously spent so much time with to be able to write about them so well. I'll probably be forced to write about refined and intelligent people like myself. Well, enough about me. Good luck to you and your family." But I think it's interesting that her name is, and she says respectfully and affectionately, Pizza J. McCorkle. I did write to her and asked her if she was putting me on, you know. And I wondered if she was really 12 and a half years old. I think it's interesting, though, that the reaction of people to the way my characters talk and what they represent, that the reader will say, and the critic will say, it's that realistic sound. It's that must be the way it is. But how do they know? You know, if like pizza, if they're not familiar with the sleazeballs and lowlifes, how do they know I'm really portraying them accurately? Well, I find out when police officers come to me and say, God, or lawyers who say, I've represented all of those people. So then I'm sure. But for the most part, it's fiction. You know, you use your imagination, you imagine being these people and sit down and then write from their point of view. In the September 30th New Yorker, which came out last week, there's an article about my researcher. It's called Elmore's Legs, and it's a good piece. It isn't very long, Alec Wilkinson, the writer, went to Florida to see Greg Sutter, who does all of my research, and followed him around a little bit. In fact, they both came up to the Detroit area where I live, and we talked. It's a very interesting piece, and you'll see how I get the authentic sounding backgrounds and professions, occupations, the bail bondsman, for example. Another reader writes, I keep hoping no one will write a doctoral dissertation on your work and screw the whole thing up. And this was from a woman. And she said, it was bad enough when I saw George Will writing about you. And I was afraid, she said, I was afraid that might be the kiss of death. And I think it was interesting, though. George Will, he wanted to interview me. So we met in New York, and this was some time ago. This is probably 10 years ago. We met in New York for lunch, and I said, why are you interviewing me? And he said, because I can write about anything I want, and I've read 10 of your books. So I don't think he took any notes. But the next night he was home, I was still in New York, he called me up, and he read the column to me, which no one has ever done before or since. And I said, George, you're a good writer. And he thanked me. And I said, it sounds like you. And he said, well, I hope so. I said, no, I think most writing just sounds like writing. But your voice comes through. It's funny, because I've been told that my sound kind of comes through, where in reality, it's not my sound at all in my books. It's always a character's point of view. Most letters that I get, or a lot of the letters that I get, are from aspiring writers and who want to know if there are any secrets, if there are any hot tips I can give them, any kind of encouragement, any kind of secrets about writing the successful query letter just to get in to the publishing company. How to get an agent? That's the big question. But I think too many aspiring writers believe that once you get the agent, your troubles are over, and the agent will simply sell it. And the agent is hard to get. A good one is as hard to get as a publisher, and sometimes even harder, because the agent is not going to represent anything that you write that the agent doesn't believe is saleable. He can't afford to. There was a once in a while I'll get a manuscript or parts of manuscripts, but I don't read manuscripts. I can't. I sent back a manuscript once with a note saying I don't do this because it's not what I do. It's not my work. I'm not an editor. I have no judgment about these things, and it doesn't matter what I think, really. And I don't have time to read. I don't have time to read all of the things I'd love to read. And even if I did have time, I doubt very much that I'd read manuscripts, because it's work. And why would I want to do that? So I told, in fewer words than that, really, I told this, the writer, that, and he wrote back and he said, I would have thought that a letter from a professional writer would have been more artfully crafted. And then, of course, I was tempted to write back to him and to tell him that you craft artfully when you have a contract or when you have a pretty good story idea. But I didn't. I'm glad I didn't. I had an agent. I was lucky that I sold a story to Argosy magazine in 1951, and then an agent contacted me after that, right after that, and then she represented me all through my Western period in the 50s, at which time I sold about 30 short stories and five books. And then I didn't write anything for a while. I did educational movies and industrial movies and just freelance writing, because I had left the protection of the large agency, ad agency, where I was working, had gone on my own, and found that I had to hurry up and make a living, as well as, and even though I was doing this in order to have more time to write fiction, I found out that I had to make some money too. So it was a few years then before before I wrote something else and sent it to my agent in New York. It was called The Big Bounce. And she was ill and sent it to the agent in Hollywood, H.N. Swanson, Swanee. He was a legendary individual who died at 92, about five or six years ago. Swanee had represented F. Scott Fitzgerald and Raymond Chandler. Raymond Chandler came to Swanee for representation. He said, I'm working at Warner's and I'm making $150 a week. This was probably in the late 30s, and Swanee said, I don't represent writers who make $150 a week. And he called the studio and got him raised to $750. That's a story that he tells. He said that Fitzgerald came in to him with this manuscript called West Egg or East Egg, and he said, "You got to change that." That was, and of course it became The Great Gatsby. That was when I first met Swanee. Years later, the way he told the story, he then told Fitzgerald, "You got to change that to The Great Gatsby." So, and Swanee was responsible for the line when asked what kind of writing brings in the most money, he said, ransom notes. He drove me, the first time I was in Hollywood in 69, I was doing a rewrite on a film script. He drove me past his house and he says, "Kiddo, there's my house, on 3.5 acres, right in the middle of Beverly Hills. The only house on the block that doesn't have a mortgage." Then he drove me past the house again in 73, and finally in 84 he invited me into the house. And I said, "Do you realize you've been representing me for more than 30 years, and this is the first time I've been in your house?" And he said, "Well, you weren't making any money to speak of until lately." And this is the kind of agent to have, really. Because the agent's editorial advice, for the most part, is worthless. It's not his job. But the first thing he said to me when he called me up in 1966, when he had read The Big Bounce, and then he was going to try and market it, he said, "Kiddo, I'm going to make you rich." And he got 84 rejections then on both coasts in the next 3 months. But we were both confident that it would sell. And this was my first effort at writing something that wasn't a Western. And he did eventually sell it. And it was one of the worst movies ever made. And it opened, when it opened in New York, I was in New York, and I went to see it. I got in a little bit late, and about 15, 20 minutes late, and then maybe 15 minutes later, the woman right in front of me said to her husband, "This is the worst movie I've ever seen in my life." And the three of us got up and left. Then I told that story on Greg Kinnear's show about two or three weeks ago. And I thought, well, now I've told it nationally. I won't be able to tell it anymore, except that Greg Kinnear comes on at 1:30. So I figured it was worth, it's good for a few more tellings. A college English instructor told me that he used several of my books in his courses. And he uses them in a way one studies. He said, "Gatsby or The Sun Also Rises." And I asked him what he saw in analyzing my books. And he said, "Oh, patterns of imagery, psychological and thematic coherence." He says, "All the stuff of academia." And I didn't know what he was talking about. And I wondered, what if I took his course and I read my books and failed? I think it could happen. As I'm not at all aware of patterns of imagery, there's a magazine in London, Time Out. And I think it was Time Out, but they called me the poet laureate of wild animals with revolvers. And Viking even used that as a blurb on the back of the book, but I don't think an American publisher would dare to do that. But speaking of the British publisher, was very proud of the cover for Out of Sight. And they used a photograph of a woman holding a shotgun in a black suit with a short skirt, the way it's described in the book. And the publisher called me and he said, "Well, I hope we got it right. I hope we got the black suit right and the shotgun." And I said, "Yes, they're fine. But you photographed a woman with long black hair, and Karen Sisko in the book has short blonde hair." And he says, "Oh my God." I don't think there was anything he could do about it. But that might work in England. I mean, this kind of a photograph that looked like True Detective, you know, that looked like a detective pulp magazine from the 40s. A critic stated one time that the subtext of my work is the systematic exposure of artistic pretension, which I thought sounded pretty good, even though I thought I was just trying to make a buck, you know. Or that my work, someone else said, is an indictment of civilization and its byproducts. A more realistic reader tells me in a letter, "I just finished Bandits, and the ending was so goofy it made me furious. What a stupid ending. Roy gets a bullet for his time, and a murderous Indian and a spaced-out rich girl walk off with all the dough. Please, no more stupid books. P.S. The ending of Stick was almost as goofy and unsatisfying. You're a weird guy, dude." So I think that may be a more accurate appraisal than... I was asked to contribute to a book called Who's Writing This? And the subtitle was Notations on the Authorial Eye. And they asked different writers, from Margaret Atwood to Updike, Joyce Carol Oates, Arthur Miller. They asked us to describe how we see ourselves as writers. And what I wrote was, what he does And it's from the point of view of a character, you see. What he does, he makes us do all the work. The people in his books, puts us in scenes and says, go ahead and do something. No, first he thinks up names. Takes forever to think up names like Bob and Jack. Jackie for a woman, female lead, or Frank. Years ago, anyone named Frank in one of his books was a bad guy. So then he used Frank as the name of a good guy one time, and this Frank wouldn't talk. And he refused to come out and become the kind of person Elmore wanted. So he changed his name to Jack after thinking of names for another few weeks, and it felt so good, you couldn't shut the guy up. I mean Jack, not Elmore. So he names us, and he says, okay, start talking. And that's what we do. Sometimes if a character has trouble expressing himself, he's demoted. Is given less to do in the book, or he might get shot. There's a case of that was, there was a character in Bandits where the principals were planning to steal money that was being raised for the Contra cause. And the reviewer said, well, I don't have to worry about ever being invited to the White House at that time. They were going to steal money that would be sent to the Contras. And there was an IRA agent in New Orleans who was also interested in the money that was being raised. He was interested in arms, primarily. And to research him, I went to Dublin and looked up an Irish journalist that I had met in New York one time. And we hung around, we sat in pubs and talked about it. And I said, I wonder if there's a connection between the IRA and the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. And I talked to, he introduced me to a fellow who was supposed to be a courier for the IRA between Dublin and Belfast, and he didn't know. The strange thing was, I bought the IRA newspaper off the street in Dublin, didn't open it until I got home, and when I did on page 10, there's a picture of Sandinista minstrels singing their revolutionary songs in Belfast. So, but I had filled this little notebook with Irish-sounding expressions. I don't mean slang, just the dust bin instead of the trash can, just things like that. And I gave these expressions then to this character, talking to other people in the book. And when he finally, when I ran out of things for him to say, he was having lunch at Ralph and Cacu's in the French Quarter in New Orleans, and he went into the men's room, and another character followed him in and shot him in the back of the head. He might have lasted through dessert if I'd spent another day in Dublin. Anyway, what can also happen if a minor or even a no-name character shows he can talk, he can shove his way into the story and get a more important part. So Elmore names us, gets us talking to each other, bumping heads or getting along okay, and then I don't know what happens to him. I think he takes off, leaves it up to us. There was a piece written about him one time in the Village Voice called The Author Vanishes, and it's true. And I don't want you to ever be aware of me. That's the whole idea of the way I write, that you're not, I don't write in the classical fashion of, that you would say, oh, look, listen to that prose. Isn't that interesting or lovely or whatever prose? No, listen to those people. Listen to those people talk. I want to immerse you. I want to bring you right into the book so that you're never aware of me. And I don't use any words that my characters wouldn't use or don't know. I don't want my writing to sound as though it was written. And I always think of, say, a sentence that would begin, upon entering the house, and I've probably used that in the last book, you know. But that's what occurs to me as the way we were taught to write, you know. I don't want that sound. I don't think I've ever used the word suddenly in writing a screenplay. It's a sin to use the word besides. And every movie that you'll see, somewhere along the line a character will say besides, and then that gets you off in another direction without exchanging too many words, you see. But how many people use the word besides? Of course, as soon as I say that, I said that to my daughter, and she stood, every other word then was besides, you know. Well, there are smart alecks like that you have to contend with. I try to move the story with dialogue. When I'm writing a scene, I write in scenes, and when I begin one, I try and think, well, all right, what's the purpose of this scene? How does it move the story along? And from whose point of view is the scene best told? And sometimes I'll write it from the point of view of one character and then try it, same scene, write it again from another character's point of view who's sitting over here, and it sounds completely different. It might work a lot better. And it might take a little more time, but so what? Someone told me one time, well, you know, you should use a word processor because I use a pen. I'm still trying to make the pen work. I do have a typewriter. I put my work on the typewriter as I go along, but all the composing is done in longhand. And it was only until last summer that I finally got an electric typewriter. I'm moving right along. I had a manual typewriter I bought about 20 years ago, used, and finally it fell apart, and you can't find manual typewriters anymore. But now I'm used to the electric typewriter. Anyway, there's no reason for me to write faster. My editor claims that she can tell books that are written on word processors by the authors who had written previous books the normal way. I shouldn't say that. Everybody uses the word processor now. And she says they're not as good. The books aren't as good. And she thinks it's because they look good. You know, they're so easy to put down. I mean, to fix and rearrange and there. Now, that looks good. So it must be good, you know. But I'm not concerned really with how it gets onto the paper. I'm more concerned with how the words fit, get arranged in my head. Because I do write in scenes, all my stuff has been bought in Hollywood or optioned, just about all. I think 28 or 29 of the 33 books have been optioned or bought, plus short stories and some originals, like Mr. Majestic was an original screenplay before it was a book. I did one for Clint Eastwood, Joe Kidd, a Western, and didn't write the book. And I've always wanted to get involved with movies. And in the very, very beginning, I was purposely writing with movies in mind in writing Westerns, because Westerns movies were big in the 50s. And I thought, that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to sell a serial to the Saturday Evening Post that would run 7 or 8 times, and then have it picked up in Hollywood, the way The Searchers was, the way She Wore a Yellow Ribbon was, Fort Apache, and so on. But my stories, all but one, were turned down by the Saturday Evening Post because they said that they were too gray. They were too relentless. You had to have blue sky in them. You had to have an important girl You know, the school teacher or whoever it might be at that time. And you had to have some comic relief. You had to have Gabby Hayes, or not Gabby Hayes, but Guy Kibbe, if anyone remembers Guy Kibbe. You had to have somebody like that in it, which I wouldn't do. Anyway, I have been selling to the movies, and then since Get Shorty, there are a lot more of mine that have just been sitting on shelves and now are very active. But Donald Westlake wrote to me in a letter one time, and he said, "Why do you keep hoping to see a good movie made? The books are ours. Everything else is virgins thrown in the volcano. Be happy if the check is good." Carl Hyacin wrote, "After a long meeting with producers and staff, two of the participants took me aside to recommend movies which will guide me. I think he was adapting Skin Tight at the time, not the more recent one. One of them urged me to see The Gauntlet, Clint Eastwood, while the other guy suggested My Fair Lady with Rex Harrison. Please, do to Hollywood in your novel what these SOBs do to us." And this was when I was thinking about Get Shorty. And at that same time, John D. McDonald, who refused to get involved with Hollywood, he wrote to say, "I don't see how you could endure those people and endure group effort and endure conferences and stupid revision requests and kindred bullshit. Please, write the Hollywood book and kill them off in ugly ways." So both... both of those guys wanted me to kill them, you know, and I don't think they deserve that. Jim Harrison said, "I have written 13 unsuccessful screenplays plus options for an awful lot of money, also an awful lot of dead writing and disappeared money." He did feel that writing movies, for him at least, was better than teaching, the novelist's other alternative in making a buck. But what surprised me, Jim Harrison used to have a column in Esquire, and it was a food column. And he sometimes mentioned food in it. More often than not, he didn't tell what about one of his escapades in Hollywood. Raymond Chandler's advice on working in Hollywood: wear your second best suit, artistically speaking, and don't take things too much to heart. You should have a touch of cynicism, but only a touch. The complete cynic is as useless to Hollywood as he is to himself. You should do the best you can without straining at it. You should be scrupulously honest about your work, but should not expect scrupulous honesty in return. You won't get it. And when you have had enough, you should say goodbye with a smile, because for all you know, you may want to go back. Or you may have to go back. This is a letter I received from a television production company affiliated with 20th Century Fox. And this fellow says, "I'm the producer here." He mentions another fellow's name. "And I are producers here at 20th Television. We are currently producing between 5 and 6 movies a year for Fox and a drama series for the BBC. Prior to this, I was an executive producer of Home Alone and various other studio features. As part of our brief here at Fox, we were going through the Fox film library. We were delighted to find that your great novel, Ombre, and the fine film based on it were part of this library. This is one of the definitive Westerns of all time." Now he tells me what it is. "Possessing the classic themes of corruption by wealth, the responsibility of the outsider to society, racism, greed, and honor," which I think probably covers everything. They love themes in Hollywood. I never think of theme. I just think of what's going to happen next, and I know when I've reached the end. But I always wait for someone else to tell me what it's about, what the theme is. Anyway, he says, "We love it. In short, we would love to remake Ombre. Since Westerns are currently not the easiest material to sell, we would like to set the story either in the present or in a science fiction context." since science fiction provides the backdrop for many of the same themes that Westerns once did, we believe that the latter option best serves the story. This is especially the case now that motion picture technology makes the sci-fi effects needed possible for both feature and television productions. We hope the project is of some interest to you, and we look forward to hearing from you. And I told my agent to just, well, they could do what they wanted, you know, they own it. So I just didn't want to really be involved. But you can see that when I was writing Get Shorty and being aware of things like this, that there was no shortage of material. I was in the middle of Get Shorty when my book Kill Shot was finished, and the manuscript had been sent out to by the Swanson Agency to different production studios and producers. And TriStar claims that they made an offer and that someone in the Swanson office accepted the offer, and that we had a deal, that we had a verbal agreement that I was going to accept their offer and sell it to TriStar for Bruce Willis. And I said to Swanson, I don't want to sell it to Bruce Willis. I can see him in the part, in the male part, but the guy's wife is the main character. And I was afraid if he had control of the story, it would become his story and not the woman's story. And so I said, I don't want to sell it to him. They said, well, TriStar. I said, but you have. You've accepted our offer. And we argued about that. And they said, look, you name the producer. You can name any producer you want, someone you have confidence in, and then you'll feel better about, you know, losing control, which, you know. And they say, and you can be a creative consultant, which means absolutely nothing. And it's not even worth much money. So I said, okay, I'd like Laura Ziskin to produce it, because Laura Ziskin was doing pretty well then with some movies. And No Way Out, Kevin Costner movie, was just before that. And and Laura Ziskin liked Kill Shot a lot and wanted to produce it herself. And they said, we don't want Laura Ziskin. So then Bruce Willis called up and said, why don't you want me to do this? And I said, because I'm afraid you'd make it your story. And he said, shame on you. And he said, I want to do it exactly the way it is in the book, The Iron Worker, that part. He said, I can see a little problem in the end, or it might need a little work, when he's 700 miles away from the conclusion, when his wife handles the situation. And so he said, look, why don't we let our agents get together and work this out? So I called my agent and I said, I don't think it's a matter of you and his agent. I said, how about Laura Ziskin and Bruce Willis sitting down together? Let's see if you can arrange that, which he did. So Laura Ziskin reports to the agent's office and is sitting in the outer lobby when the Bruce Willis's agent calls mine and says, have we got a deal or not? If we don't have a deal, I'm sending the broad home. And my agent said, no, we don't have a deal. Let's see what happens in the meeting. He says, if we don't have a deal, I'm sending her home. So nothing happened. So I came to the part in writing Get Shorty where Chili Palmer and Harry Zim, Gene Hackman played that part, are having dinner with Michael Weir, Danny DeVito, Shorty, and they're eating at Michael's in Beverly Hills, and Michael Weir's agent comes in, and joins them. His name's Buddy. So this was Michael's agent. Buddy was supposed to know Harry, but didn't even glance at him. I'm reading from the from the book. He started right in with, "They want you to take a meeting with this producer they keep talking about. You believe it? The guy's a writer. I mean, he writes books, not even screenplays, but he wants this broad as the producer. I never heard of this in my life." "I want the property," Michael said. "Don't worry about it. You get the property." I said to the guy's agent, "What is this? You're trying to hold a gun to my head? We have to take the broad?" "Which is out of the question." I said, "What if there's no communication between she and Michael? What she made? 3 pictures? One did okay, the other 2 barely earned back negative costs." "I want that book," Michael said. "Michael, you'll get the book soon as we get done with this pissing contest." "If it was a director, yeah, I can understand. He's got a producer he likes to work with. But this is a writer." I said to the agent, "Hey, Michael doesn't have to option this book, you know." And the agent goes, "And we don't have to sell it." I go, "Well, the guy, what's the guy writing for? He doesn't want to sell his work. You ever hear anything like that?" "You have to understand his motivation," Michael said. "A writer can spend years working on a book he isn't sure will ever sell. What makes him do it?" "Money. The idea of hitting big," Buddy said. "Selling one to Michael Weir. What else? Look, what we do, we say okay to the meeting. The broad arrives, we ask her to wait a minute. Be right with you. I call the guy's agent. And I say, do we have a deal? Come on, we have a deal or not? We don't have a deal, I'm sending the broad home." Put it to them like that. I guarantee you within 5 minutes, we'll have a deal. Chili watched Michael playing with a book of matches that would never be used for lighting cigarettes, because he had given them a little monologue about smoking, so they had to quickly put their cigarettes out. Michael said, "How you handle it is up to you." Buddy said, "I'll give you a call." So he leaves, and there was something Chili wanted to know, and he said to Michael, "What he mentioned to you there, you mind if I ask, what if the other agent says, okay, you got a deal? Then will you have the meeting with the woman, the producer?" "I don't know. I suppose," Michael said, "we'd talk to her. I'm not really involved in this." Harry said, "Chill, it has nothing to do with Michael." And now Michael was nodding. All it amounts to is a power play, the dance of the agents circling each other for position. "With the woman in the middle," Chili said, not knowing what's going on. "I was thinking she's sitting there like a hostage. Use her to get what you want." "Hey, come on, man. All I want is a book." "They say no deal. What do? Shoot her?" Chili smiled. Michael didn't. He said, "Why is everybody giving me a hard time?" And a little later, in that same scene, ordering. And then finally Michael had to look at the menu for a while, Harry willing to bet anything he wouldn't order from it. And this was in the movie. It was an unwritten rule in Hollywood. Actors never ordered straight from the menu. They'd think of something they had to have that wasn't on it. Or they'd tell exactly how they wanted the entree prepared, the way their mother back in Queens used to fix it. The $7 million actor in the jacket a bum wouldn't wear told the head waiter he felt like an omelet, hesitant about it, almost apologetic. Could he have a cheese omelet with shallots, but with the shallots only slightly browned? The head waiter said, "Yes, of course." Then could he have some kind of light tomato sauce over it with just a hint of garlic, but please no oregano? Of course. And fresh peas in the tomato sauce? Harry wanted to tell Michael, "You can have anything you want. You want boiled goat? They'll send out for it. If they don't have it, Jesus, what you had to go through with actors?" The ideal situation would be if you could make movies without them. Then that actor Ed O'Neill, who's you know Ed O'Neill, he's in Married with Children. He called me up after reading Get Shorty, and he says, you know, it's true. He says, actors don't order from the menu. He says, I'm even starting not to. I'd like to see him in one of mine. Some of the movies that, since Get Shorty, that have come about, Paul Schrader has shot Touch with Christopher Walken, Tom Arnold, who's pretty good in it, and Bridget Fonda. And Pronto has been made for Showtime with Peter Falk. And I had a good time on the set with Peter Falk talking to him. And then Chili Palmer, the original Chili Palmer, whose name I used for the character in Get Shorty, and whose background I also used because he was a loan shark on the streets of Miami. He showed up on the set of Pronto, and I introduced him to Peter Falk. And Chili is really a tough-sounding guy. And within 2 minutes, Peter Falk sounded exactly like him, like they're a couple of thugs talking to each other. And then Peter Weller is going to direct one called The Switch. Gold Coast for Showtime. And Maximum Bob is going to be a series on ABC. It's going to be written by the same guy who wrote Get Shorty, same director. And they also, both of them, are working on, at least the writer has completed several drafts of Out of Sight. His first draft was 184 pages. And he figured, he says, I got to cut at least 50 pages out of it. I don't know what to cut. And I told him I was glad that I didn't have to do that. I don't write screenplays anymore for the simple reason that it's work. And for the same reason that I don't review books. And the editors of the New York Times, Sunday book review, we had lunch once, and he said, nobody can understand why you won't review books for us. I said, because it's work. Because it's an assignment. I said, all my life I did that. Finally, 10, 15 years ago, I reached the point, I can now write whatever I want. You know, I've said that I've written everything but cocktail napkins, and now I don't have to do that anymore. And also, when you write book reviews, you have to sound smart. You have to sound like you know what you're talking about. And you don't want to dump on some poor guy who's hoping against hope that you'll say something nice about his dumb novel. So, and it's funny that when Get Shorty came out, when the movie came out, and it was reviewed, there were reviewers who said that it's riding on the coattails of Pulp Fiction. It's taking advantage of Pulp Fiction. It's inspired by Pulp Fiction. And the same reviewer who says that admits that he knows that Tarantino was influenced by me. That Tarantino has said that I was the first writer who you meet a couple of the antagonists and they're talking about something very everyday, commonplace. But before you know it, they've got their guns out. But you think they're just regular guys, you know, and then all of a sudden, because they are just regular guys until they commit a crime. And one of my favorite scenes is in the book Kill Shot, which also he's going to write. He's going to write it for Tony Scott to direct. And he wants to play a character that I'm going to read, Richie Nix. I'm reading this because this is an example of the kind of thing that he recognizes in my writing, where a kind of a normal scene tension can come out of a quiet scene. I call this The Bad Guys at Home. Armand Degas, one of the characters, is a French-Canadian Ojibwe Indian hitman for the Toronto Mafia. Richie Nix is a young stick-up guy. He's about 28 years old. His ambition is to rob a bank in every state of the United States except Alaska. And Donna Mulroy, they're hiding out. The two are hiding out in the home of Donna Mulroy, who is a former corrections officer at, I think, I've forgotten where it was now, where Richie Nix did time. And they had something going in prison. So in this scene, this is in the evening after supper. Donna started talking about Elvis. She said, if Elvis was Jesus, you know who I think some of his apostles would be? I think Engelbert would be one. I think Tom Jones would be one. And I think going way back, the Jordanaires and the Blackwood brothers. Who do you think? Armin said he never thought about it before. This was while Donna was clearing the table, setting the dishes in the sink to wash later on, and Armin was waiting the 45 minutes it took for another chicken pie to heat. They had one each for supper, and he was still hungry. Richie was in the living room watching TV. Donna moved on from Elvis and his apostles to Elvis's greatest hits, to how she had tried one time to get a job in corrections down there, to be near Elvis's home. The West Tennessee Reception Center was her first choice because it was right in Memphis. When they turned her down, she waited a year and tried again, requesting Brushy Mountain, DeBary Correctional, Fort Pillow, any one of those. Even the Tennessee Prison for Women in Nashville would have been better than nothing. And you don't think there wasn't some kind of conspiracy to keep me out? Armin never said there was. He was waiting for that Swanson's chicken pie to hurry up and get done. Donna told him the memory of Elvis was like a giant magnet drawing her to Memphis, that if she lived there, she'd visit Graceland every day, the way people visit a church and light candles to get their burdens lifted or find a boyfriend. She'd do it knowing peace of mind didn't come cheap, but you don't think it wouldn't be worth the $7 admission to have some in my life for a change after what it's been? Armin said, I believe you, because he could see she believed it herself. She had a look in her strange eyes behind those glasses like she was drugged or had been hit over the head. Donna served him the chicken pie, left the kitchen and returned with a stack of color photos taken at Graceland Mansion. She had bought the prints off a girlfriend of hers for $2 each and kept them in that velvety box a fifth of amaretto comes in. Armin, mopping up chicken gravy with slices of bread he'd fold over, could look at the pictures as Donna held them up, but he couldn't touch them. This is Elvis Presley Boulevard on a rainy day. This is the Heartbreak Hotel restaurant. It's not too far. I hear him sing that, I get goosebumps, bumps head to toe. I mean still. Okay, this is his famous pink caddy. This is his lavish jetliner, the Lisa Marie. This is inside it. No, this is inside his tour bus. Elvis would bring some of his closer friends along on tours. They'd play cards, Yahtzee, listen to music. They'd cook right in there. What's the name of it? Armin said, wanting to show he was interested. The tour bus? It don't have a name. This is the front room of Graceland. That couch seats 14 people. How come his airplane don't have a name? How come his airplane has a name but not his tour bus? If people knew he was in that bus, like if there was anything on it to identify him, there'd be a riot every time it stopped. Well, he could call it some other girl's name, like the jetliner. Bird, that isn't just some old girl's name. Lisa Marie's his daughter. Her and I have the same birthday. Yeah, is that right? I'll tell you something else, Donna said. My life number is 8. What do you mean, your life number? You add up your date of birth. Like February is the second month, that's 2. I was born on the 1st. 2 and 1 is 3. Then 19, 1 and 9 is 10. So that's like 1. You add that to the 3 you get from February 1st, then add up the next numbers, and I'm not going to tell you the year, and it comes to 8. Is that right? Okay, now, add up 3797 Elvis Presley Boulevard, P.O. Box 16508, Memphis, Tennessee, 38186, and you know what it comes to? 8, Armand said. And you wonder why I'm drawn to there? Donna said. Think about it. Okay, this is some of his personal jewelry. His gold Rolex watch, his Maltese cross and solid gold ID bracelet. Here's his famous American Eagle jumpsuit. His famous queer outfit, Richie said, coming into the kitchen. Jesus Christ, Bird, you eating again? I'd take the Rolex and the pink caddy. The guy did have a certain amount of class. Richie was getting a bottle of beer from the refrigerator. But that jumpsuit, would you wear it, Bird? You'd have to get the one he wore after he swole up like a pig. You're jealous, Donna said. You can't look at these without making remarks. Jealous of what? You know what the difference is between him and me? Yeah, you're ignorant, Donna said. I'm alive and he's dead, and that's the only thing counts. You're alive, Armand thought, watching Richie take a swig of beer, his fist wrapped around the neck of the bottle. But you don't have to be. He noticed Richie was chewing gum with his beer. I got news for you, Donna was saying. After you die, you think anybody's going to visit your grave? Even if you had a mother, I doubt she would. But 100 years from now, even longer than that, people will still be going to visit Graceland. She looked at Armand and nodded. It's true. Is that right, Armand said, feeling a little sorry for her. Richie was grinning, chewing his gum and shaking his head. Donnie, you're so goddamn stupid. Let me ask you a question. Which would you rather have, Elvis sing to you or go to bed with you? He looked at Armand and winked. Armand stared back at him. He didn't think Richie was funny, now or any time before. He watched Donna squinting at Richie, showing him she was being serious. I know what you think I'm going to say, Donna said, and you'd call me a liar. Well, I can't help it, because it's true. I'd rather have him sing to me. Armand believed her. He was surprised that Richie did, too. Richie looking at him, saying, you know why, Bird? Because he wasn't a con. Elvis wouldn't have been rough or smelly enough for Donna. I don't think of him that way, Donna said. He was a kind, generous person who helped people out, and he gave them cars, whatever they needed. He believed people oughtn't to suffer more than they don't have to. He read books. They say he was ever in search of the answer to life's mysteries. I heard he was ever in search of pussy, Richie said. Had girls brought to him and he'd take his pick. It might be true. Armand didn't know or care, but he decided that was enough. He was tired of Richie. So when Richie looked at him, fun in his eyes, waiting to be appreciated, Armand said, leave her alone. Richie said, who, Donna? Maybe a little surprised, but still having fun, enjoying himself. Armand decided to push him. He said, see if you can keep your mouth shut for a while. And the fun was over. He watched Richie's eyes become serious and then dull, sleepy, covering what he was feeling, no longer chewing his gum. Wanting to hit me with that bottle, Armand thought, smash it across my face. Now he gave Richie a frown, curious. Not a bad look, and he says, what's the matter? And Richie said, you ever talk to me like that again? And Armand said, yeah, what? Because he wanted to hear how this punk would say it. It'll be the last time you do. Nothing original about that. The guy remained a punk. They stared at each other, Armand wanting to tell him, okay, now go watch your TV. But there would have to be more staring if he did, and he was tired of it. So he didn't say anything, and Richie walked out of the kitchen with his bottle of beer. And for a few moments, there was a silence. Donna cleared her throat. This is Elvis's billiard room, Donna said. There are 750 yards of material, all pleated, covering the walls and ceiling. So because of things like that, I get letters that say, I'm currently incarcerated in the middle of the Mojave High Desert. Dreary and boring. How I ended up here is a long, unbelievable tale involving dysfunctional women, heroin, and pure foolishness. I was driven to write because I enjoyed several of your books so much that I harassed some of my fellow convicts and forced them to give up their usual reading fare in order to read Maximum Bob, Swag, and a couple of others. They are very conservative in their reading habits. And this was no easy thing. Jacqueline Suzanne is a huge favorite here, which says something about both her and the inmates. Anyway, your books are the first ones I've liked and could share with my beloved semi-literate fellow criminals and maniacs. See, bad guys are funny. There are several different theories on how you became so familiar with those who break the social contract, the disconnected and the outright boneheads who exist on the fringe of society, and if it's embarrassing or violates some strange writer's code, please keep your secret to yourself. But if you wouldn't mind terribly, we're all wildly curious. A fan from another prison writes, one guy that I told to read Switch, The Hunted, and 52 Pickup thought you were either black or an ex-con. You must do excellent research. I tell them, of course, that they have never done time. I've gone to a few AA meetings, but I've never done time. And there are our inmates who would like to tell their own stories. I'm presently doing 8 years for the feds, a woman writes, but looking at hundreds of years for fraud. This includes bank, computer, wire, ID, and mail fraud. All white-collar crimes, and they want to put me away for life. Is there no rhyme or reason to our justice system? I do creative writing and have an agent in New York, but my work is very raw. I think she has a chance, though. My reason for writing is that I'm in prison and have been to prison 4 times, 3 times for armed robbery. I am not proud of that in any sense, but I have committed over 200 robberies and have done them in many different ways, and I truly believe the crimes I have been involved with could be very entertaining in story form to many people. Well, I'm way ahead of him, you see. He said, even many convicts find them very interesting and ask me over and over, how'd you rob those Safeways? Here's one from, this is from Danbury Correctional. This is a federal facility. I thought you might be interested in a report on your growing popularity among this prison's hardcore readers. While Harold Robbins, Sidney Sheldon, and Lawrence Sanders remain the most generally popular authors here, more and more of our hardcore are discovering you. This group includes a few college-educated whites, quite a few American-born blacks, Italians, and pre-Mariel Cubans. Some of your recent converts are Charlie, 24, a heroin seller out of 143rd Street, Harlem, Stanley, 35, a heroin seller out of the Kenilworth Projects in D.C., and Mike, 40, a heroin seller from Pittsburgh. Your books don't seem to have attracted the cocaine and crack people yet. Because, of course, they're younger, wilder, and less educated. The Italians like you, but they prefer Judith Krantz and Sidney Sheldon. Anything about the lush life in New York City. Jamaicans read Westerns, Africans read nonfiction, Indians and Pakistanis read the Wall Street Journal. This last letter is not from an inmate, but is not from an inmate, but an individual who nevertheless is certainly troubled. He writes, a couple of years ago I wrote a poem in the Japanese haiku form in your honor, and it was published in a poet's column of the Honolulu Advertiser newspaper at the time under a pseudonym, and it just occurred to me that you might enjoy reading it. And it's not a frivolous poem. It describes a real situation then. And in three lines, it says, I wanted to kill myself, but Elmore Leonard just wrote a new book. So now he's put me on the spot. Now I have to write a new book every year, or this guy's liable to go off the deep end. I'm out of letters, and okay. Thank you.
That was Elmore Leonard speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 1996. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. Theme music for the Archive Project is by Emancipator. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.